Welcome to the Choose Your Own Adventure podcast, a place to have authentic conversations about the things in life that really matter. Welcome back to the Choose Your Own Adventure podcast. I am Wes Cothers, and who you just heard there is Tony Criz. So we are back, and for all of you who listened to our first episode, I hope you enjoyed it. There was something that Tony said on the first episode that I was curious about as I was editing that first episode, and so I wanted to start off asking him about that, and then we're going to go into one of our adventures. So, Tony, when
just before we get started,
yeah,
I was thinking about the title of our little podcast, Choose Your Own Adventure. And so, growing up as a kid, I didn't read at all. I had some learning troubles and stuff, and so I didn't read. But the only books I did read were Choose Your Own Adventures. And when I was listening to our first podcast, it was really fun. It got me thinking back to my first Choose Your Own Adventure book. And I remembered specifically it was Choose Your Own Adventure number 8. And I actually remembered the number, which is funny because I'm 43 years old now and I haven't even seen those books in probably 30 years. And it was Dogwood City. Dogwood City?
Uh-huh.
Something like that. Anyway, and I can still remember now, over 30 years later, I can remember a certain choices I had to make. I remember there's one where you walk into a saloon and you're playing stun, and they tell you what cards you have in your hand, and you can either like go for a flush, or you can go for like 2 8s or something. And if you go for the flush, you'll lose and it sends you one direction. And if you go for the 2 8s, you end up winning. You can continue the adventure. Anyway, it's just funny how much I remember those things from being a kid.
Nice. Kind of stirred your memory banks there. Yeah. Was that the picture you put on your blog of that particular?
I had to go find it because I remembered it so clearly. I actually had to go find it.
Nice. That's awesome. Was that like a play on Deadwood maybe?
Yeah. Maybe it was Deadwood City. I can't even. Anyway.
Yeah.
I had to go look it up, and it was, anyway, it's funny.
Yeah.
It's funny how much things we remember from when we were little kids.
Totally.
That's... I wish I had that memory now. I don't.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. It tends to fade. Yeah, seemingly more. I'm about to hit 40 here in about a month. And yeah, not what it. November 15th.
That's my sister's birthday.
Really?
October 29th, man. We're just a couple weeks apart.
Well, you know what's weird about that is my brother's birthday is October 28th. So.
Well, you know what's weird about that is Halloween is October 31st.
Yes, we are all in the fall. Good times. All
right. That's enough for my little Choose Your Own Adventure excursion.
Yes, memory lane. All right. So you had said when I had mentioned the shirt you were wearing at the conference that I first met you at, the Atheism Communism Free Love crest.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of Reed College. You had said that is your personal picture of heaven.
Yeah.
And I was very curious to exactly what that means.
Yeah. So, so first of all, it's not the official motto of Reed College, but half their t-shirts have it.
Oh, okay.
Atheism, communism, free love as sort of the three driving values of the Reed College campus. And for those people who don't know, Reed College is here in Portland, in Southeast Portland, and it's widely considered one of the most progressive colleges and universities in America. I heard once that, I know for a fact that they have more Rhodes Scholars per capita or whatever out of Reed College than any other college university in America. Most of the students who go there, like, they got accepted to the Ivy League and decided the Ivy League was academically stringent enough for them or not progressive enough for them. And so they end up going to Reed instead. And it is, according to Princeton Review, it's the college most likely to ignore God. And according to another periodical, it's the second most academically stringent university in America.
Wow.
Asking the most of each of its students. So anyway, atheism, communism, free love. So one day I was actually standing at a conference. Somebody asked me about the shirt. I was actually speaking at a Christian conference. And I was wearing the shirt. And they came up and they were a little perturbed by the shirt. And I just off the cuff, without even thinking, I said, yeah, that's my picture of heaven. Atheism, communism, free love. And they're like, what? And then suddenly I was stuck because I made this statement and now I need to justify it. And I looked at it and I go, well, free love, what about God is not about free love, right? So clearly heaven will be free love. And meanwhile, the back of my brain is spinning trying to get answers to the rest of them. And like communism, like sharing everything and caring for the least among us, that sounds like Acts 2 and 3, doesn't it? Wouldn't it make sense that heaven would be like communism? And then I had the third one, atheism, and I'm kind of stuck. And I was like, and atheism is, well, how's that not heaven? Because, and then I'm kind of pausing, trying to come up with the answer, my answer. Then I said, because the Bible says that faith is belief in what we cannot see. So once we can see, there's no need for faith. Atheism. No reason for faith anymore because we fully see. That's my vision of heaven. I luckily got out of that one barely by the skin of my teeth.
Nice. So you just threw that phrase out there like you had never thought of that before?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I'd like to get there on the first two. The third one I just kind of had to come up with on the off the cuff.
Yeah, that's pretty good, man. Very cool. All right, so choose your own adventure, Tony. We have two potential paths. Which one?
All right.
Which one will you pick? Okay, so we have church controversies in the Northwest.
Oh, man.
Option one. And religious identity. Option two.
I'm gonna take religious identity for 200 there.
All right. So, religious identity for 200. How do you define the space between evangelicalism and progressive Christianity? And what religious labels do you apply to yourself, if any?
Wow, great. So, a two-part question that I've stumbled into. The space between evangelicals and progressivism, I think, can take a lot of different forms depending upon the person. There are actually people who are sort of soft on evangelical theology, things like the inerrancy of Scripture, things like that, but they're still pretty strong on sort of conservative social values.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of people there who are basically become more like what I would argue are like political evangelicals. They're not so concerned about the faith or the theological side. So those would be some of the people that are in between evangelicals and progressivism. But then you have the flip side, which are people that are sort of soft on, or they're really strong on sort of evangelical theology. They still believe in the proclamation of the gospel. They believe in the authority of the Bible as the central and unique document of faith. Mm-hmm. In this encounter between humanity and God, they believe in the importance and the centrality of the church and that we live in connection with one another as people of faith. But then they're moving into a more social, what I would call more social agenda on the political, cultural side.
Right.
And that's where I would place myself. Like I'm The most of the things we talk about here around my household, and I live in a communal household with other people, my family and other people, we all live together. And when we are having dinner together, we're talking about questions of the poor or the marginalized or because we're a multi-ethnic household, we're talking about a lot of issues of culture and ethnicity and the divide that has between those two. It's, it's a well-known quote that the most segregated hour in America is 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're deeply concerned by about those separations between culture, class, and race in society today, that there are entire populations of people that are pushed into the margins of our society today because of their economic class or because of their background or because they happen to be immigrants or any one of numerous reasons. And so that's sort of the space that, that I think my family and most of our, mostly our household inhabits is we're very devout. Like I would call myself an evangelical. Absolutely. So we inhabit a fairly conservative theological space, but also a fairly progressive social space when it comes to the marginalized and the poor.
Interesting.
So the second half of your question was, how would I define myself? You know, about 10 years ago, when I first, 10 to 15 years ago, when I first moved back to the States and moved back to Oregon, and with all of the sort of negative press around the church, I was playing a game that I feel like a lot of people play, which is I was trying to sound cooler about my faith, trying to make my faith easier for people to swallow. So I was always referring to myself as a follower of Jesus, or I'm a spiritual person who, and my primary guru is Jesus, or something like that, you know, whatever kind of BS I was giving people at the time. And honestly, today I'm just a Christian. I really am. That's what I call myself. When I'm out in the streets of Portland, I refer to myself as a Christian. And one of the great things about post-Christian culture, which is where we are right now in Portland, at least in the Inner East Side of Portland, is people are not turned off by the term Christian anymore. They're really not. They think it's a perfectly valid sort of way to define oneself. And since we're, we Christians are a minority group now in the city, in a post-Christian city, we are no longer a threat. We're not perceived as a threat sociologically. And so I just refer to myself as a Christian, honestly, Wes. And I'm actually really happy to do that. I don't feel any sort of weirdness within me and just say I'm a Christian. That's the tribe, the historical tribe that I'm a part of.
So you're kind of willing to kind of own all of that comes with that term, positive, negative, everything.
Yeah, and again, in a post-Christian society, I think it begins fairly neutral with people now, where maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago, even here, and I'm sure it's still true in many parts of the country, you're starting in a negative when you call yourself a Christian, and I think you start fairly neutral now.
And you think that's true beyond Portland even?
Well, I think it's true in post-Christendom.
Okay.
So we could, I imagine it's true in San Francisco. I imagine it's true in parts of Seattle.
Yeah.
And in urban centers in other parts of the country. But, and that's one of the shifts that's happening. I don't know if we're going to have a chance to post this before this weekend, but I'll be speaking at the Christ in Cascadia conference this weekend up in Seattle. And, that's specifically a conference that's been designed to kind of talk about what do we do in this new Pacific Northwest reality of post-Christendom and how, what does it mean to be academically, philosophically minded within the Pacific Northwest? And, so I'm looking forward to a chance to be with those people and speak on those topics this weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like some good stuff. So here's another kind of part of that. That idea of evangelicalism and progressive Christianity. Do you, when you're kind of talking with people and just conversing about these ideas, do you observe any kind of progression from one of those to the other?
From evangelicalism to progressivism or the other direction?
Either way, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think the dominant movement today is from into a more progressive mindset, at least among my generation and younger. People are becoming increasingly, they're just becoming less concerned about arguing the things we used to argue. They're less concerned about, so the inerrancy of scripture, for instance, is just, it's not a fight a lot of people want to have anymore. There are other fights that are more important to them. And unfortunately, one of the things that I'm witnessing is evangelicals that are moving towards what I would call progressive Christianity, a more progressive framing of Christianity, it's really just a way station on their way out of the church, honestly, by and large. When people are making that movement, it's eventually going to be a move out. I mean, I talked to four people last week, old friends of mine that I used to go to church with, who basically went on that journey. And now they're out. They don't want anything to do with the church. They wouldn't even call themselves Christians or followers of Jesus anymore. So that's the reality I'm witnessing.
Wow. So what do you make of that? I mean, why do you think that is happening?
Wow, that is a huge issue, buddy. I think for a whole variety of reasons. I think one is we're not telling the story of God very well anymore. We're not telling the story in a way that captures people's hearts and helps them believe that the ongoing story of the gospel, the ongoing life of Jesus in the world, is worth giving your life for. We're not doing that well. I think we have a lot of disillusioned people who are tired of pretending. And this is one of the, this is my kind of a pet topic of mine or pet concern, but I think the church propagates a culture of pretending. Pretend like you're doing better than you are.
Yep.
Pretending like your doubts don't exist when they do. Pretending like our relationships are stronger than they actually are.
Yeah.
And the pastor stands on the stage in his perfectly coiffed hair and tells us a triumphalistic message of how he has it all figured out and the gospel's working for him or her. And meanwhile, the people in the audience are going, it doesn't work for me. It doesn't. But when I stand up and I go to the foyer and I shake people's hands and I say, good morning, brother and sister or whatever, I have a perfect smile on my face and everything's great when they ask me and the kids are great and my marriage is great. My faith is great. And it's not great.
Yep.
It's not great. And I think it's a very, very powerful historical adage that's existed really universally that that when things are left in the dark, they have much more power and they're much more destructive. And when things are brought into the light, that there is a chance for healing and there's a chance for growth.
Yep.
Just like, I mean, the metaphor of a plant. You know, you put a plant in darkness, it'll die. You bring it into the light, it'll grow. And we have a chance to grow and to become green in our souls when we are when we have the freedom to bring things out in the open. And so much of religious culture, and I would argue, it's not just religion, it's political culture does the same thing.
Yep.
The use of absolutes, the use of triumphalism, and, you know, other realms as well. And that's where people are in a lot of, I think people are in a lot of pain. And our system's just not working for them anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree. As a therapist, you know, I'm talking with people all the time about pretty deep matters. And I totally agree that bringing things into the light is one of the key things to become more healthy. And yeah, I think the church often is a great place to hide, you know? Like you said, I'm going to pretend everything's great. No one's really going to probe any deeper because we're all just kind of we're colluding and we're kind of agreeing that we're all going to just pretend that everything's great and God's great and there's no problems whatsoever.
Right.
And, yeah, I think that does lead to, can often and does lead to, you know, all kinds of problems and pathologies and.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's not appealing to the world really. But yeah, I think those things happen outside the church too. You know, I think, the whole us them thing, you know, I've seen that happen in many spheres beyond religion. The group that I grew up in, you know, most of the people who leave that are extremely just wounded by the whole thing, and they really just want nothing to do with any of it anymore. Which is probably similar to people who leave evangelicalism. I mean, I've noticed a lot of similarities. And on some levels, like, I get it. You know, I kind of empathize with them. Like, yeah, if that's what it is, yeah, I don't want that either. You know, I think where I differ is that I still think there's something, you know, so I'm not willing to just abandon the whole thing, you know, faith altogether. And that's why I like having these kind of conversations is that, you know, you're a guy who still embraces faith, but you're willing to, you know, talk about the hard things, be honest about the state of things, and not just pretend everything's okay.
So, can I tell a story?
Yeah.
So, I was at a wedding a couple weeks ago. I was actually officiating the wedding. And there's this group of people sitting and talking. And this this opinion is brought up of a lady who has left the Christian church long ago, left it. And she was mad. She said, I hate Christianity, and I hate your Christian story. It's a horrible story. Hmm. And I was like, yeah, talk. And she's like, it's a horrible story. This whole story that God's supposed to be all loving and this incredibly creative force. And yet, the angry father God, like, sends the son God to go and, like, die and separate. And the angry father God's like, whatever. And the son has to sort of just take it. And this incredibly creative God can't come up with a better answer than that. I mean, there's got to be a better answer than that one. And that's the best that God can come up with. Mm-hmm. And it's just, she was angry. She's like, it's a horrible story. And I looked at her and said, that is a horrible story. Mm-hmm. I think that's an awful story. I hate that story. I could never believe that story. And in the circle, it kind of landed with a thud, as you might guess.
Yeah.
And because I had just officiated the wedding as, you know, the minister.
Right.
And the rest of the circle was sort of talking about it a little bit and kind of trying to explain how, you know, it's not really that way and blah, blah. And then eventually the story that sort of ended in this awkward silence. And then somebody asked me, well, what would you say? Like, what would you say the story is? And I said, well, it's not that. That's not a story I'm going to live for. It's not even conceivable, this idea of the angry father kills the son and the impotent sort of mother spirit God sits off to the side and can't do anything to stop it and is just silent through the entire process. Like, that is a horrible story.
Uh-huh.
That is a horrible, horrible story.
Yeah.
If that story existed in one of our neighborhoods, we would seriously get, like, public services in there to deal with that story. That's a horrible story.
Seriously.
And I was like, I don't think that's the story at all. I would frame the story very, very differently than that.
Mm.
And then I was quiet. And I just sort of let that sit for a minute. And somebody said, well, then, okay, how would you frame it? And I said, well, I could frame it a lot of ways that are better than that, but here's one. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, okay. So in the 16th century, Russia was in the middle of, it was tearing itself apart. They were on the verge of revolution. Clan against clan, brother against brother, sort of classic destruction of a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, in the midst of it, there was a guy named Saint Sergei, who was sort of the spiritual father for Russia at the time. And he believed in a revolution of love, that the only thing that could save Russia at the time was a revolution of love. And Saint Sergei had a pupil by the name of Andrei Rublev. And Andrei Rublev was not a great orator like Saint Sergei was, but he was an artist. He had an incredible grasp of color and shape and form. And Andrei Rublev one day was the first to write the icon of the Holy Trinity. And it's basically when he wrote it or did this icon, when he did it, it's a depiction of the life of God, right? And it's three figures sitting around a table. Three figures sitting together on the table, equal in size and importance. And as they sit together, it's an image of love between these three figures, which was supposed to represent the Father, Son, and Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And in the middle of the table is the cup of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And all three figures are equally sharing the cup of suffering. It's not one suffers and the others just watch. They're all equally sharing. But here's the amazing thing about it. If you look at the icon, there's a cup of suffering in the middle. But then if you look at the figures, the body of the figures that represent Father, Son, and Spirit, the figures, the shape of their bodies is also the shape of a cup.
Mm.
That their body is the shape of the cup of suffering. So the cup of the suffering is not just something that they do. It is something that God is. Because that is what love is. Love suffers. And if anybody who has children knows what that means, you suffer for your children every day. And throughout all of eternity, God's natural state is to suffer for us. At all times, in all places, the community of God suffers for the creation and suffers for humanity at all times, in all places. So what is the cross? The cross is sort of a change up in God's story. It's not like a new concept. It is just the bringing into the light, the ripping open of the curtain of eternity and letting us see what God is at all times and all places, the suffering God for us. And Jesus just was the lucky one who got to go on display to show it. But when Jesus steps to the middle on the cross and suffers and shows what God is, the loving, suffering God for you, and I looked at the lady and I'm like, for you? When Jesus is doing that, when the curtain is being ripped open, it's the Father holding one side of the curtain and the Spirit holding the other side of the curtain and ripping it apart so we can see what is true, what is eternally true. And that is a story that I will die for.
Mm-hmm.
That is a story. And I just looked, I said, I agree with you. And if you can't find a better story, then you should leave Christianity.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And that's what's going. We are not giving people a story that they can live for.
Yeah. Yep. Go ahead. What was that?
No, that was just a long story.
No, that's okay. So how did she respond to that?
Oh, it was good. It was good. I mean, it's just sort of something to think about. I don't think anything in particular came out of it, at least in the moment. Uh-huh. That's kind of how life is too, right?
Right. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, no, I completely agree that the version of the story that she mentioned is super, just depressing and yeah, not something I want anything to do with. And I loved the story you just told. So, you know, what's interesting about that is I think her experience really echoes a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, and that story that she told is pretty much the gospel according to a lot of evangelicals.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And, oh gosh, that just is so sad to me. I don't even know how to get, like, when I first, you know, kind of left the group I grew up with and, you know, started to seek faith in other realms, basically the only thing I was very ignorant of the whole thing. And I was in the military and I was in the Air Force and, there was a guy on base, part of an evangelical kind of parachurch organization that, I went to one of his Bible studies, just kind of checking it out. You know, I was skeptical and everything, but, you know, he was a nice guy and very grace centered and everything. And so yeah. I became, you know, kind of a disciple of this guy for many years. And it was a very formative time and God did a lot of really cool healing there and it was really good. But all that was, you know, he basically had that same story in a sense. Like he was very gracious to me personally. Like our relationship was very grace based, yeah. But he still had all of that theology too. So there were times where we would have conversations and I would bring up some of that and he didn't really, you know, I had problems with it and he didn't really want to go there with it. And so, you know, that became problematic. But I thought, well, this is it. You're either this or you're Catholic. Like that, I didn't know there was other, you know, conceptions of this stuff right. out there, you know. So I was just like, well, I guess this is it. I don't really have a choice in the matter because Catholicism, I was still very ignorant of that too. But that reminded me more of where I came from in some ways too.
Yeah.
And so I just think it's a difficult thing that, there's just not an awareness of anything other than that, because that is the dominant story that is told as the quote gospel.
Right. Right. Yeah. Did you see the article I wrote for Christianity Today this week that got published?
The one about giving up certainty?
No, the one about exploring the gospel message from the book of Acts.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I did.
It's on the Leadership Journal website. And, you know, some of it was that idea. Like, we have this really sort of highly formed, rigid message that is the quote unquote gospel. And yet I'm not really sure the Bible supports that concept.
Yeah.
That it's actually a fairly mysterious, almost amorphous thing that we are sort of stepping in and out of as we communicate the gospel. And the 13 gospel messages in the book of Acts are really our evidence of that.
Yes. Yeah, I really liked that you guys kind of broke it down into very specific categories and not just, like you said in the article, Christians preaching to Christians.
Right.
Yeah, which is a very different space than what happens in Acts.
Yeah,
good stuff. I think I will put a link to that on our podcast page, and people can check that out. So yeah, man, good conversation. I enjoyed that. I could go on for longer, for sure. But I think we're probably right about 30 minutes.
All right,
approximately.
You got another short choose your own adventure we could go on really quickly.
Yeah. If you want to,
little bonus adventure.
Bonus adventure. Church controversies in the Northwest. So,
so we're going there. All right.
Yep.
All right.
So, yep. What is your take on the Mark Driscoll controversy?
Oh, gee, my Christmas. So I've known Mark for about 15 years. My wife and I helped plant a church here in Portland. We were part of the original team, and I was on staff at that church for a while. And that church was a sister church to Mars Hill.
Hmm.
And so I was pretty intimately involved in the formation of Mars Hill Church. And back in the early days.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, yeah, we would do retreats and stuff together, and was pretty connected to the story. I've watched this thing. I've watched this thing for a long time. I remember sort of how sort of the power features played out even in the early days. I've always been uncomfortable with some of Mark's rhetoric. It's hurtful. It's hurtful sort of rhetoric. But I'm just trying to think what's the most helpful to say. You know, I've never written a blog post or a Facebook post about because I don't want to. I don't want to be in that side of it.
Yeah.
There's plenty of people writing about it right now, and I want nothing but good things. I've got several friends who are that are leaders in the Mars Hill branch here in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm walking with them and talking with them about what's going on as they're trying to figure out how to be good leaders and how to be a redemptive voice within their church. And I want to be that. And I don't want to be a guy who's, you're a therapist, Wes, you know this. Like, I think one of the great weaknesses of the human psychology is to do what's called the good-bad split.
Mm.
Say something is all good or something is all bad.
Yep.
Something is totally dismissible or absolutely embraced. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted, there's nothing. There's nothing out there. And I love Tim Keller, for instance. I think Tim Keller is arguably the most talented Bible teacher in the country right now.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he walks on water. I don't think everything he says is great. I think he's a man.
Yeah.
Who does good. He's doing a good thing, you know. But he's just a person.
Yeah.
And Mark Driscoll's the same way. He's not all bad. He's not all good. Mars Hill is not all bad. It's not all good.
Yeah.
It's a church that is trying to survive and in deep, deep, deep pain.
Yep.
And at the same time, I would also say that there needs to be, from Mark's standpoint in particular, for there to be healing for himself.
Yeah.
When I'm talking about the church and culture for himself, I have not seen personally the contrition that would need to happen.
Yeah.
I just have not seen it yet. And I want that for him.
Sure.
I want that for him, regardless of how things move forward. I want that for him. And my greatest fear is that a year from now, Mark will be starting another church in Seattle and pulling large chunks of the current Mars Hill people. And it will be sort of business as usual, but maybe even a little more extreme, because now it's going to actually be a reaction.
Yeah.
The church itself will be a reaction against the circumstances. And if I were to try, if I don't want to be prophetic around this, but I would not be a bit surprised if a year from now that's where we're at. There's another church that has started in downtown Seattle.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a likely outcome. And you know, referring to our earlier conversation, you know, I went to that church a couple times. I went to school up in Seattle, and I live in Tacoma now, but did go to grad school up there. And at the time, the school I went to was called Mars Hill Graduate School.
Right.
And I didn't know about any churches in the area, but when we moved here, I heard about that one, and I thought, oh, well, that's got the same name as my school and Acts 17 and where that comes from. And I love that whole portion of scripture where Paul, you know, talks about the unknown God and all of that. And so I thought, well, this, you know, this might be a cool church. So I went and checked it out, and I was just blown away by, the difference in kind of the school's, way of being and some of the stuff he was saying, which was very similar to, what we were just talking about of kind of that story of the gospel that is, kind of harmful and hurtful. And, it was just really sad to me. And I even told my school, I was like, yeah, I think, we might want to change our name or something. Cause if we get mixed up with this, people are going to think that we think that story of the gospel is good. And we like that. And they didn't listen to me at the time. Eventually they changed it. I think.
Yeah, they got kind of bogarted off the name.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, as the controversy grew, you know, this was back in 2004, but I went there, but I think, you know, as you said, it has kind of grown over time. And, I think that kind of stuff is what creates people like the lady that you saw at the wedding, you know?
Well, maybe. And Wes, again, I want to be really careful here. I think the vast majority of the things that come off the stage of Mars Hill and out of Driscoll's mouth are perfectly good.
Okay.
Are perfectly, I don't want to paint that broad brush there.
Okay.
The same way that I don't want people to paint a broad brush on me, you know. I think,
sure.
I think in many ways the reason that that church grew so fast and such, because they were presenting a different story in many ways, and that was life giving to their congregation. I think there's a lot of people who were on their way out of the church when they found Mars Hill, and I want to hope in that.
Right.
I want to hope in that better story.
Sure.
And that they're evolving the same way that you're evolving and I'm evolving over time, that's happening, and we're hopefully evolving towards the Jesus way.
Yeah. And, my intent of asking this question was definitely not to kind of demonize Driscoll any further than he already has been, but, just to kind of get your take on it, and then just share my experience. And again, I only went the two times. And, you know, so I don't know what the majority of what he says was.
Right.
I just know those two times, and I've heard him say things like God objectively hates certain people, and, you know, just other things like that, that, you know, in my mind is just the opposite of the gospel. So maybe that stuff just gets more airplay, you know,
for sure.
Which makes sense because it's more controversial. But yeah, I mean, I hope the guy is, you know, able to find some contrition and, some redemption and all of that for sure. And especially the people at the church. I think that's where my biggest fear is that maybe, you know, oh, just like you were saying earlier, people who are kind of on their way out, you know, they just experience something like that controversy and are like, you know, just forget it. I'm, this is all whatever. And coming from where I come from, that is what people do from the group that I was a part of. As they kind of, you know, as they kind of learn more about, you know, the group I was raised in, there's a lot of stuff that people don't know about until later. And with the internet, you know, people kind of start learning different things and they're like, you know, and it reminds me of what you said, even when you were a kid and you were kind of contemplating between, you know, either there's something wrong with me or there's something wrong with this whole story.
Right.
And I think people often have that crossroads and they just say there's something wrong with the whole story and I'm out of here.
Right.
And so I hope that isn't the case. And, I think the hopeful thing about it is, you know, maybe this will create a place where people can be honest. you know, yes. And not pretend about things and say, hey, there's some real problems here and let's talk about them.
Yeah. It's great. All right, everybody. We just want to say thanks for listening. This has been the Choose Your Own Adventure podcast with Wes and Tony. Please come back, track us on the website or on our iTunes page. And it's great having you. And we're going to continue to have, hopefully, redemptive conversations about culture, faith, and just life in general. So thanks for being here. Bye.
Thanks, everybody. If you'd like to leave comments, questions, or submit topic suggestions, please go to cyoapodcast.wordpress.com.